Well, when I was preparing my talk last night, watching some movie or other, I realized as I was writing, there's a lot of background that is useful to understand if you're thinking about this subject, and the subject is measures and eternal inflation. And so I had the choice of either, you know, going quickly over it and, you know, getting sort of doing a little bit of everything, or spending a long time and sort of really trying to describe what we're doing. And this being Santa Barbara, I've decided to go long. Now, it's important to have a sharp cutoff in these things because they don't go forever. My plane leaves at 7. So that's the cutoff I am observing. Yeah, and then it will be like having a channel clicker. You'll have a free choice of what channel to choose for. And I certainly won't be offended.
Do you have picture-in-picture?
I'm sorry, I don't. If there's a hotel that has that, I'd like to be put in it next time. But it'll be right recorded, so you can go see whichever one you want on your laptop. And if you have picture-in-picture on your laptop, you could watch both.
I have as many windows as I want.
Yeah, right. So why are you here? Okay. So what I'll try to talk about is what I've come to think is an interesting problem of how to define measures, and I'll say what that means. In eternal inflation, and I'll restrict myself to what is often called old eternal inflation, which is the kind involving nucleating bubbles, and it's not the kind that's called new eternal inflation. And the bit that is new in this is work I've been doing with Alex Maloney, who I guess till recently was a postdoc at Stanford and now is a postdoc at the Institute for Advanced Study, and Lenny Susskind, who is the new director of the Creative Writing Program at the Stanford Institute for Theoretical Theory. And myself. All right, so certainly one of the most spectacular phenomena in quantum gravity is the phenomenon of inflation. We imagine we have some model with a scalar field and some potential of a kind that you all are familiar with, and some metastable minimum at phi naught, and a height of a potential that's above zero at v naught. And soon we'll complicate this to have a few other bumps and wiggles and to turn it into what we know and love as something called the landscape. If you happen to sit in this metastable minimum, you have a vacuum energy above zero, and the universe does something spectacular. Its volume exponentially inflates. Then you have a scale factor that grows, I guess it's like 1 over the Hubble constant, e to the Hubble constant times time, where the Hubble parameter is determined in terms of this height given by up to constants of order 1 by v naught over m Planck squared. Or if you write v naught as a characteristic inflationary mass scale to the fourth, then h is given by so it's parametrically lower than this inflationary mass scale. And for inflationary scales far below the Planck length, this is an important distinction to bear in mind. And just to set notation, if you're sitting in this De Sitter space place, you can describe the causal diagram as some kind of conformally compactified coordinates. The time is a finite extent, even though real time, of course, runs over infinite extent. And this is where the scale factor goes to infinity. And you have an observer here sees an observer horizon. The size of that horizon is finite. It's a Killing horizon, so it has a temperature. And that temperature is given by effectively h. And it has an entropy. The entropy, of course, is a quarter of the area of the horizon in Planck units. The entropy is something like m inflation or m Planck to the fourth over m inflation to the fourth which is something like m Planck squared over h squared. So the entropy can get very large as the Hubble parameter gets small, the temperature gets low. So there's a negative specific heat situation here as well. Now, this in fact was the first model of inflation that Guth studied to enormous effect, and he realized that this exponential expansion, and I guess for further purposes I'll just describe, you have a metric that looks like in co-moving coordinates, dt squared, or FRW coordinates, I guess, a of t squared times a three metric squared, and this is a homogeneous an isotropic metric. You can think of it, one possible choice is flat space, or you can think of a sphere or negatively curved space, whatever you want. And the size of the sphere, say, blows up exponentially, and that's the vivid indication of inflation. Now, this being inflating solved a lot of problems, as Guth, you know, magnificently pointed out. But there was a problem about how to end this process and get into a universe we liked. And the process he thought about in ending it was to tunnel from this metastable minimum down to this true minimum. And a well-developed technology for computing this had been developed using instanton techniques by Coleman and DeLucia. And you can imagine making a bubble going from here down to here. And you have a small bubble that exponentially expands. The walls of that bubble soon start traveling at the speed of light because there's a large energy difference between here. So if you nucleate a bubble here, its walls effectively trace light rays. And so there's a couple things to establish. This is the region that now is true vacuum, if you will, and this is false vacuum. It doesn't take up all of conformal infinity. The closer you get, the less of conformal infinity it takes. So the bubble doesn't eat up all of the de Sitter space. So one bubble doesn't cause an exit of the whole space. Second, inside the space, it's you have zero CC, so you have a standard FRW metric with zero cosmological constant. Because it starts off with some curvature present, it turns out by analytic continuation, this is a negatively curved FRW metric. It can be sliced like this. And then its causal future will look like that of a standard zero CC FRW metric. Those will be the constant FRW time slices. I guess I should make this more symmetric. And so the second thing to observe is there's an infinite volume on each of these slices. So there's an infinite universe that you describe. Even though you might start in some sense from a small bubble, you've created a whole infinite universe. Okay. And if you then did the same thing over here, you'd get a whole separate infinite universe. So this one de Sitter space can produce an infinite number of disconnected infinite universes. This has made some people nervous, but a lot of strange things you have to accept. We'll talk more about this in a minute. So the real problem here for Guth, really, said in modern languages there, is that these thin bubbles don't generate any energy. All the energy goes into the reheating of the domain walls. So these are empty, cold FRW universes that are dominated by curvature energy. There's no radiation, no non-relativistic matter, nothing to make us. The only way that hope in such a picture is that when these bubble walls collide, they could generate enough stuff to make us. Okay. Well, so in order to know that, you have a lot of bubbles colliding when a lot of bubbles are nucleated. So it's interesting to know what the rate for bubble nucleation is. And so you do this instanton calculation, and crudely speaking, although this is subject to important qualifications, in a picture like that, the tunneling rate for unit time, let's call it lambda, and let's make it dimensionless by putting an h to the fourth. So that's a dimensionless number. This is a tunneling rate per unit time per unit volume. This is dimensionless. How many bubbles you make in a Hubble volume, in a Hubble time. This goes like an instanton action, which is characteristically given by e to the minus the entropy of this de Sitter space. And this is often called the inverse recurrence time. Now, actually, it's parametrically usually shorter than that. There's some coefficient of maybe a small number times this. But this gets the scale. Okay. And so the first thing to know about this number is that it's very small. You can do an estimate. Suppose this well is actually quite high. It's up at a gut scale. Gut to M Planck is a factor of 10 to the third. So the entropy is M to 10 to the third raised to the fourth power. It's like 10 to the 12th. So this might be e to the minus 10 to the 12th. You know, situation that should go pretty quickly. It's actually, when you estimate it in these cases, it's substantially less. It might be as small as e to the minus 10,000 or something. Yeah.
Is this for mutating a bubble of order the Hubble scale?
The bubbles are always of order the Hubble scale. Okay, so if you think about, the way you think about this is you study Euclidean de Sitter space, which is like a sphere of diameter, the Hubble scale, and then you slice it off. And the characteristic scale is the Hubble scale. So you imagine this instanton, more accurately, the domain walls look like that. Then they started from a Euclidean cap. And that cap is always of order the Hubble scale. So the bubble that's nucleated is the Hubble scale. Then it expands.
But you want to assume area height is comparable to the
height of the middle. Yeah, that's right. That's the way where you can monkey with this in various ways. The recurrence time is probably an upper limit, I think, to this tunneling time.
But the Hubble scales are very small than the Planck scale. Then it's really a field theoretic instanton.
Yeah. Well, a field theoretic instanton that uses gravity. Well, oh, I'm saying, is it?
Gravity is important or not?
Oh, let's see. When does gravity get important? I think that's right. Although, yeah, I think if all the scales are much less than M Planck, although they're. I'm sorry, it's not M Planck, it's the scales related to H. The kinds of situations where you could worry about gravity getting important is if, you know, this H scale was a high mass scale compared to these. And yeah, that's the thing you have to worry about. Is if there's some prime reason the critical, I'll give you an indication of where it might get important. Suppose these were symmetric, okay, then the actual bubble size would be much larger than the Hubble size. You know, in cases like that, you do have to worry about the feedback on of gravity. That's right. Yeah. But in any event, the formalism exists, and it's just a question of when you can use flat space intuitions and when not. Okay.
Your bubble actually is mp squared, mp to the fourth n, so you must be assuming gravity is important. It's not field theoretic.
To get e to the minus s. Yeah. So what will happen sometimes is that if field theory is important, then this becomes such a small fraction of the total entropy that it's only field theory. It's a field theory number. So if this number is given by something close to this, then gravity is important. But it can be parametrically less than this if field theory drives it. Okay, and so those are the cases where this is a substantial overestimate.
See,
yeah.
There are some potentials that are not so ridiculous where the dominant instanton isn't this whole individual one, where it's something like Hawking Moss or whatever you mean by the words.
Yeah.
Does that change any of your story or
not qualitatively. Quantitatively, it will. Yeah. Well, for the discussion I'm about to make, the crucial thing is the size of this tunneling rate. And a number like this suggests, let me call epsilon this dimensionless tunneling rate. If this is equal epsilon, epsilon is much less than 1. That's what's important for this discussion, and it's often a very good approximation. Okay.
So why isn't everybody in the beginning of these universes? Why do you tunnel right to the bottom and not roll around for a while and dump some energy into?
Let me see how this works. Because you essentially go right to the domain wall, and the thin wall approximation goes right to the bottom, and the thing expands out.
No.
No, I'm sorry. What happens?
Over.
Yeah. What happens to the oscillation?
Well, the energy's all in the wall, I think.
Yeah, the energy all goes in the wall, but why doesn't the thing eventually rattle around?
Well, there's rattling, they decay away. You're in an expanding universe, but the wall doesn't decay away, right? I
mean, right. That's but the point is, all the energy never gets into radiation.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember why that is.
As long as a very small approximation is appropriate, then you have a very cold vacuum in the middle.
Right, but I'm trying to give the intuition about why you don't have fields rattling in the bottom of the well. Somehow that's...
It keeps getting diluted.
Their energy density retches away very quickly.
The energy of what?
Of those oscillations.
Right, but does that mean the thing isn't slow roll? Does that mean the thing isn't slow roll all the way to the bottom? It probably does, actually.
If you tried to make the potential a slow roll potential, it would. But for a generic potential, it would be fast roll and just go away.
What go?
The curvature dominates over.
Yeah.
Part of the thin wall.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think. So actually, if you were tracing the domain wall, it'd actually oscillate and drive radiation out, or you just say the domain wall, the thin wall thing would oscillate.
The wall connects the inside to the outside,
right?
Those two different vacuoles.
Right.
And then, since you don't tunnel immediately right to the bubble,
right,
you tunnel close, and then inside the bubble you oscillate a little bit.
Right.
And those oscillations are just redshifted away.
Oh, I see, because the curvature, the point is the curvature scale drives the... Yes, you mean it's all in the zero mode of the scalar potential. It effectively never converts to radiation. So in fact, what Guth and Weinberg did is estimate the possibility for reheating from that and found it was completely inadequate. It gets redshifted away quite quickly. Right. Yes, I guess that's the point. And so somehow that says the H scale is large compared to somehow energies of producing radiation, in fact, because that's the curvature part of the FRW equation. So that must always dominate over the radiation you make. I guess that makes sense because any radiation would come from the curvature scale. Yeah. That's a more refined version of the argument. Okay. So given a physical situation where epsilon is much less than one, what happens in this putative de Sitter space? Well, what happens is initial tunneling might look like that. Then there will be another tunneling that looks like that. And then there will be another tunneling that looks like that. And they would both have little, I guess what Lenny calls hats riding on top of them for the causal structure. And you get a diagram that looks like this. Some sawtooth picture like that. And in many ways, this is the logo of old eternal inflation, is this sawtooth structure. It's kind of a peculiar structure because you might say, well, maybe you have gaps like here. If you take any time-like whirl line, this lasts an infinite amount of real time. So the probability that some tunneling event will start on this line is 1. So up to probabilities, it's probability 1 that there's no vacant place on this future time-like infinity. Okay, so you have this kind of sawtooth, and there's no finite measure of empty de Sitter space left on it. But nonetheless, it is not just a flat space. It's a fractal. And the fractal dimension of the space where you haven't exited is finite. And it's that fractal dimension that's in some ways the signature of eternal inflation. Okay. We'll get to that in a minute, but just as a contrast versus when epsilon is of order 1, well, then the tunneling time is comparable to the Hubble expansion time. So in one Hubble time, you nucleate a lot of bubbles. So you'd have a picture like this, where all the bubbles would coalesce. And by the time you got onto the top, there wasn't any room for empty stuff, even little kinds of things. Okay, so this is not eternal inflation, finite inflation, and this is eternal inflation.
Is there really a phase transition?
Yes. Yeah, but there is a phase transition. That's what's interesting. Well, sorry, it's actually irrelevant, but it's interesting. It's interesting to me because of my schooling. I'll tell you why in just a second. So let's develop actually some order parameters for this phase. The order parameter, and this is actually, I've learned this from a guy named Wisniewski, is one of the collaborator of Olenkin's, is one of the heroes in figuring this stuff out. The subject of eternal inflation really goes back to Guth and Weinberg, who studied this, then studied by Olenkin and Linde and other people. And it's really a very rich thing. A lot of that work has been devoted to studying new eternal inflation when you have a slow roll situation. And then you also can have this kind of fractally structure. But it's a rather different kind. It's like, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's a phase transition between new eternal inflation and old or whether they're just like liquid and gas. Actually, Niemann and I had an interesting discussion/argument about this. And I think that issue is open and interesting. That might actually be an important distinction, not just an interesting one. Okay, so one way of establishing the...
You go through the epsilon small, and I mean, it's like you lower the barrier, so you're...
Well, no, you don't. No, it's possible to have... yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. It is a little bit like going epsilon order 1, because it's sending delta rho over rho of order 1. I'm trying to think, though, is there a way of going through...
I mean, people care about this a lot when they try to do electroweak baryogenesis.
Right.
They care about the
right
phase transition is first order or not. And what exactly where you care about, the thermal fluctuations are just as important as the quantum fluctuations because you're at some point in the temperature. And it is a mess. I think it is not very well understood.
Yeah, although that's correct. This is technically a different kind. This is a question of whether, given that you have sharp bubbles, is the transition from this to this first order or not? There's a second question. Given that you're in old eternal inflation with sharp first order transitions, is this meta transition of many bubbles first? You know, what kind of transition is that, or a sharp transition at all? Then there's a second transition that's, as you say, when you soften the bubble walls. You know, what happens there? So you have two axes. And I actually don't know the answer to what you said. At first glance, I agree with you, but I'm not sure. Okay, but in any event, let me give a diagnostic for following these guys. Take some initial space-like slice in this diagram, okay? And imagine following erect some set of time-like whorl lines, maybe co-moving whorl lines, it doesn't matter, and ask, on this time-like slice, there'll be a set of points, E, where these whorl lines never exit inflation. This is called the inflating set, the eternally inflating set, that, hence the capital E. Okay? This set is not empty if you're in eternal inflation. That's almost by definition. The measure of this set, that means measure in the standard measure on the slice, is equal to zero by the argument I just gave. Any line with probability one exits. But this set is not empty. It's not even one or two points. It's a fractal. It's fractal dimension. If there was no exit, the fractal, all these points would be eternal, and then the fractal dimension would be three if this was three-dimensional space. In fact, the lowest order in epsilon, the fractal dimension is 3 minus some constant of order epsilon. And in simple models, actually, this constant has been calculated. I think it's 4 pi over 3. And there presumably are corrections to higher order in epsilon. Okay. So it's a fractal. Now, why is it such a simple fractal? I'll tell you that in a minute. Roughly speaking, this transition happens when this fractal dimension, when this fractal dimension goes through some critical point. Maybe this fractal dimension goes to zero. There are other interesting places. So one criterion is that this fractal dimension of E goes to zero. Those are criterions establishing the difference between these two. Or there's a milder, in principle, definition, which you put this thing in a box, and you have two points at the edge of the box, and you sort of imagine that the edge of the box has exited. And you ask, to these two points, is there a path, a percolating path, through exited stuff? This was the language that Guth and Weinberg used. Notice, this doesn't make the same problem as inflation. It uses the notion of percolation as an order parameter. You put two points, one in one eternal set here and one eternal set here, sorry, one exited set here and here, and you ask, is there a percolating path? Here there won't be, because this fractal dimension of the unexited stuff is close to 3. It will surround every bubble. These bubbles are almost entirely isolated. Okay. But here, of course, things will percolate. But it turns out, I think these things may not happen at the same place in general. And in three dimensions, there's different kinds of percolating. You have lines, sheets. But roughly speaking, there are several different order parameters. When epsilon is order 1, all of them click. And when epsilon is close to 0, none of them click. And there might be there's an interesting structure between them. And one of the interesting things, you can make a simple statistical model of this. I guess I'll wait a second I won't show it to you, but I'll give you the intuition. And in that model, it was proven by Jennifer and Lincoln Shays and a couple of their collaborators 10 or 15 years ago. This model had been invented by Mandelbrot 30 years ago as an interesting example of a fractal. Called it Mandelbrot. Now, he didn't call it. I guess he might have. He called it something else. Mandelbrot percolation. Other people have called it fractal percolation. And shockingly to me, percolation I've always thought of as a second-order transition. This is a first-order transition from percolating to non-percolating. That's an interesting fact in statistical mechanics. Now, how do you understand this fractal a little more sensibly? It turns out that thinking in co-moving coordinates is very helpful.
Excuse me, can I ask a
of course.
Elementary question? I guess you're drawing this picture when epsilon is very small.
Yes.
So that they never collide, essentially.
Yeah, that's a big mistake. Okay, they collide. The picture is much more subtle than that. They always collide. Yeah, so let me draw a slightly better picture. The picture, which will actually be crucially important to us later, is more qualitative like this. And again, because it's a fractal, it's hard to draw. You have a basic bubble, and then lots of things collide with it. But the things that collide are much smaller because they happen much later than the things initial bubble. And so you have a bunch of these collision sets, each of which whose width is not much greater than the original. So you have a bunch of almost disconnected collision sets. The size of this collision set is not infinite. If it were percolating, the size of this collision set would be infinite. So that's the rough picture. So, but these things are, all of these initial droplets are decorated by a dense fuzz of smaller droplets. Okay. So it's a little easier to understand in co-moving coordinates, which just means use, for our purposes, T and X here, the coordinates of this three manifold, and drop the scale factor. So you just draw a picture. Here's X, one of the three-dimensional co-moving coordinates, and here's time. And what, first of all, what do light rays look in this picture? So here's, let's say, X equals 0. What does a light ray look like? Suppose we want a light ray that starts at time t equal t naught and x equals 0. Well, that involves the advanced manipulation of setting this line element to 0 and integrating. And I'll just assume you know how to do that, and I think you get the result that x of t equals e to the h t minus e to the h of t naught. So at t equals t naught, x is 0. And so here's t naught. Here's where the light ray starts. And you see that as t increases, what did I do here? E to the minus. Yeah, so at t,
minus.
And minus is here, right. So at t naught, this vanishes. At t goes to infinity, this term vanishes, and you get something that goes like that. It exponentially goes to a constant value, which is given by e to the minus h t naught. And then, of course, you can have one coming out the other way. These are the coordinatized versions of that, the wedge. And so an important point is rapidly one of these wedges in co-moving coordinates, the volume in co-moving coordinates stays constant. So a bubble nucleation carves out a constant piece of co-moving coordinate. So you don't have to worry about the geometry of triangles and stuff. Okay. And what is the size of this patch? It's a three-dimensional sphere ball here. The size is a of t naught cubed e to the h t naught cubed. Sorry, the minus sign. Okay, so as you start later, in co-moving coordinates, the thing is smaller. That's because you've shrunk by the factor of the scale factor. But there's a second very important piece of this story, which is if you think statistically, no, I guess I'll have to redraw this. So at a given time, say t0, you nucleate a few of these droplets. At a later time, t1, you'll nucleate some droplets, and they're thinner. But how many droplets, on average, do you nucleate? Well, here, the physical space is exponentially swollen, so there are many more places to nucleate a droplet. Okay? Here, the space was physically smaller, and there are fewer places. So on the one hand, you shrink the size of the droplet by a factor of scale factor cubed. On the other hand, you increase the probability by a factor of a cubed. So the rule is that the amount of co-moving volume cut out probabilistically is the same at every time step. It just cut out in finer pieces. Okay.
Steve?
Yeah.
It's important for this picture that you're assuming there's absolutely no chance to jump back up from the exited regions.
In this picture, I'm just talking about this. You can talk about jumping back up later. You have to have a theory of jumping back up, which we'll discuss. But well, actually, I won't discuss. But if you have a theory of jumping back up, you can make a picture like this. Okay, jumping back up, roughly speaking, means you need to make a bubble bigger than Hubble. But then if the domain walls go like light rays, if you can do it semi-classically, which an instanton would do, then the picture is the same. If it's some more weird thing involving statistics, then all bets are off. Yeah, yeah.
So the times between T0 and T1 is just a Hubble time?
No, I'm sorry. This should be much longer than a Hubble time. And then the width will be in the ratio of exponential of T0 minus T1. This ratio of these sizes will be e to the minus h of t1 minus t0.
I'm still missing something.
Yeah.
You cut out the same sort of volume of these comminuted coordinates every step.
Yeah.
You still have an infinite number of time steps.
Uh-huh.
And you have only a finite amount of comminuted volume to start with. So it sounds like a finite number of steps, you won't have any co-moving volume left.
Well, suppose you do it continuously. The amount of co-moving volume will exponentially go to zero. All right. So the measure will go to zero. But notice how it's getting cut off. It's getting cut out in finer and finer pieces. So let me remind you like how a Cantor set works, if I remember. Here's an interval. The first thing you do is you divide it into thirds. Okay, you delete, one third. And then the remaining thirds, you divide into thirds. So at each step, you're deleting the same amount of volume, okay? And at the end, there's no volume left of measure. But what you're left with is a fractal. And the fractal dimension corresponds to how quickly you eliminate co-moving volume. So if the rate of eliminating co-moving volume is epsilon, you can see that this thing should be a fractal. And the fractal dimension should be of this kind, 3 minus epsilon. Okay, so it's this picture that basically gives you a fractal. Now, this is a one-dimensional picture. In two dimensions, you have to be slightly more, in higher dimensions, you have to be more careful. But the idea is the same. You also have ignored collisions here, and that's an excellent approximation if epsilon is much less than 1. Okay. So actually, I wasn't intending to describe this, but because we're starting so slowly, I'll regard that as license to be discursive. I'm just assuming it's some de Sitter space, some nice de Sitter space here.
But that wouldn't go on.
No. So I just imagine there's some initial time prepared in some nice de Sitter space. If you want, I can imagine it going back here and just starting. I have to make an asymmetric start here. So I assume that the start here is given by some nice smooth de Sitter space. Let's say I join on what the metric would look like.
So if one is after a measure, those initial conditions might matter in here?
That's a crucial question. And for some measures they do, for some measures they don't. Okay. The ones that don't have certain advantages, because you, i.e., you don't have to answer that question. Okay. To spoil a little bit of the surprise, the measure that I like particularly doesn't depend on the initial conditions, okay. Whereas the measure of some of our colleagues does. So that's both a good thing and a bad thing. If it depends sensitively on the initial conditions, what we observe might be a sensitive readout of the initial conditions. So it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. Right, exactly. On the other hand, it's not totally a tragedy. Right, exactly.
The picture could be just, in essence, coming out of one of the small gaps. You could just start with a small...
Yeah, gap. Absolutely. That's a crucial thing. Because it's a fractal, all the interesting stuff can be read off an arbitrarily small thing. It really is scale invariant. Okay, and that points out a crucial thing. If you want something universal in this measure, it better be something that has to do with the fractal scaling fractal properties, and not depend on the first stage. You'd cut the thing into four strips instead of three. Some initial transient. Maybe I'm camera shy or something, but I doubt that actually. All right, so let me just tell you, this is the model that people in statistical mechanics invented. I think actually Mandelbrot did invent it, completely for independent reasons. They started with a square, unit length, and let's say they cut it into, what am I going to be able to draw? Three pieces, 3 by 3 squares. Okay, and the first thing they did is they said, of the previous 3 by 3 squares, suppose there's a probability P that you make each square white. You make it inert. That will correspond to exiting. So here, I've exited the 2 squares. That's one step. The next step is you divide each of these squares in the same way. That's like inflation in these co-moving coordinates. We leave the total volume fixed, but we increase the number of fineness of the grid. Now, in those grids, the points that are already white, you don't do anything to. They've exited. They're gone. The remaining squares you fill in with this probability P. So 2 out of 9, so I need to take, how many out of 27? And you do it again. Okay, and you do it over and over. And you arrive at a pattern. And you can see clearly when P is very small, the grid is going to grow faster than these clusters have a chance to grow. Again, initially, every square eventually a piece of every square, initial square, will eventually exit. But you'll be left with a fractal. And here, this is very close to a Cantor set. And here, you can prove a formula very much like this is exact. There is a transition at a certain P critical where you can percolate from one edge to another. It's different than where the fractal dimension hits zero. Yeah. It's close. It's actually close. Yeah.
What sense are these coordinate invariant statements?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and we'll come to that. The quantities that will be most interested to discuss are ones that don't depend on coordinates. Or you can, again, if you have a fractal in nature, okay, describing that fractal is invariant under a lot of kinds of coordinate transformations. Okay. Okay, because you can focus at very short distances. Suppose, for instance, you wanted the kinds of coordinates, suppose, well, I'm going to get into this later, but suppose you're examining it down here. And suppose you warp your metric down here by a smooth function, any smooth function. Right. So the point is, it's invariant under any, actually continuous deformation down here. Exactly. But on the other hand, we think the fractal coordinate transformations are not quite as interesting. Okay. So it's invariant in that sense, and that's a very powerful sense of invariance. Yeah.
The close of the patch. The size of the quasar patch?
It's probably something nucleating at the initial time. So it's probably some, I don't know, bubble that goes out like this or something. I don't know.
So you get at the end many, many, many quasar disconnected patches?
Oh, I'm sorry. You want this. I'm sorry. I apologize. You want that.
So you're assuming that this lattice that you were drawing on the right hand side is actually accessible or will become accessible to a singular observer?
No. This whole set of definitions has nothing to do with a single observer. You know, people in the subject very sensibly said, who the hell cares about that? Okay, let's just draw good pictures and they must make sense. Okay. We will address that issue later. But these pictures do not depend on any of that. Okay. No. Oh, does it intersect an infinite number of bubbles? Yeah, that's a good question. I'll defer that question, but that will be of interest. The answer is yes. That will be precisely the important subject. Okay, so this is the model called Mandelbrot percolation or fractal percolation that has been analyzed rather precisely, and so it's interesting how little work has been done on this in the statistical mechanics world, and all of a sudden it strikes me that maybe there's a reason to do more. Okay. In particular, this question that was raised about if you put another axis corresponding to going between old eternal inflation and new eternal inflation, what happens here? Normally, percolation is a second-order transition. It irritates me no end that it's first-order here. Any local perturbation of percolation will leave it second-order. You can see somehow what's going on is this is a non-local perturbation because at the end of the day, this initial drop white thing covers an infinite number of squares. So there's some kind of non-local operator you've added to percolation to drive it first order. Is there another operator you can add to make it second order again? And so I think there's a conceptual set of questions here that that I think is of some interest. It also irritates me, frankly, that this was one of the first conceptual results in statistical mechanics that I know about that mathematicians found before physicists.
So what does it matter, or does it matter for cosmologists whether it's first or second?
Almost nothing, except for maybe the kinds of questions having to do with reheating. But in terms of exiting for inflation, typical tunneling rates are so far in the internal inflating regime that the transition is of at most academic interest.
Well, I mean, maybe as a related question, the working models of inflation that we know and love that are supposed to create Sandian isotropies are not first-order bubble nucleation types of things, right? So you're imagining, really, that we have one of those things and then we get more inflation after that?
Yeah. That is the consensus story.
None of this inflation that you've mentioned so far is the inflation that we just won the Nobel Prize for at this point.
Yeah, there's a question I have to ask you about that, actually. But why was the word inflation not in any of the Nobel Symposium stuff?
It's not really relevant.
I see. But despite your comment of 10 seconds ago, that was a joke.
It's a cheap joke.
Cheap joke. All right. I'm all in favor of cheap jokes. I don't mean to criticize. All right. Yes, but in the picture, well, as we'll come to in a minute, in thinking about landscape dynamics, I think the consensus picture that people in this room and others have developed is that you do a lot of landscape tunneling that's distinctly unrelated, and then the final stage, if you're lucky enough, you encounter a situation with some slow roll that can do the 60 foldings and the reheating that you want.
I mean, not for long, if it doesn't, I mean, roughly most slow roll models are eternal.
Right.
Isn't that going to play into your measure?
Most slow rolls are eternal for a while, and then in their
and then in their final,
as they roll down to the bottom, they stop being infernal, and they have a final 60 e-fold.
Okay. So I would challenge you to make one eternal slow roll model in string theory. I think that's a statement that has to do with taking super Planckian BEVs and very simple monomial potentials.
Can I just live at the top of the hill?
That null fluctuation is not be right off.
No.
Sometime, but when they don't, you get eternal.
Yeah, but
somebody in this room has conjectured that there are stringy potentials with domain wall inflation.
Domain wall inflation.
Do you stand by that, Rami, or is that that there are some potentials in string theory that are eternally inflating domain wall potentials?
I'm looking for them. I haven't.
Oh, I thought you published a paper where you found one.
I did.
No, didn't you? Am I blaming on somebody else?
Well, Sean is actually right. If you take a slow roll model,
I know.
It will be eternal, meaning.
No. It will be eternal with appropriate initial conditions way out with super Planckian BEVs.
It's typically a slow roll in the region where you get slow roll. It just says that, you have the picture of slowly rolling down, but the point is that quantum fluctuation can push you back up,
yeah.
And that's the limit between internal and non-internal. So.
No, it depends. It depends. You know where you start. If you start at a place where delta rho over rho initial is small, then you won't go back up.
Right.
I mean, it depends where you start.
You start with delta rho over rho over one. That's where slow rho.
Yeah. So again, there's a phase diagram to be mapped out, and this is a place where there's a sharp boundary, this epsilon equals 1. There's another kind of boundary you have to parametrize with potential shapes. And I think there's an interesting phase diagram, and I think in some sense these transitions are sharp in quantum gravity. They don't depend on Planck mass being, Planck g-string being 0. I think these are sharp transitions involving infinite time for finite g-string, if you will. So they are really sharp transitions in the world. Well, I shouldn't have said that. In some metaphysical version of the world. Okay. All right, so this is basically a review.
Every time the entropy in that e to the minus big suppression, that's your epsilon, that doesn't depend on the extremity. The entropy doesn't.
I'm sorry?
You said that statement didn't depend on what the string coupling was doing. Like
yeah, you're right.
That's only true for certain states in which the entropy is just given by a number, right? So take a Schwarzschild black hole. The entropy of that guy certainly depends on
yeah, actually, you're right. In fact, I was thinking the other way. A lot of transitions you have to be at finite g-string, they're smeared out. Here's a transition where as you go to G string equals zero, it disappears. Yeah, I think you're right. It's the reverse. For any finite G string, this transition is really there, I think. Okay, so but it's the reverse. I was worried about it getting smeared out at finite G string. It goes away at zero G string.
I don't know. It depends, entropy depends per measurement.
Yeah, but you're right. It'll go to infinity as G string goes to infinity. Okay. Well, I suppose you could build a system where it goes to it doesn't scale, but it doesn't. Okay. Well, so now, all right. So this. Well, I guess in the early days this was a nuisance, although you know it resulted in some very nice analysis. Early workers like Linde promoted this nuisance into a. You know, this bug into a feature, first of all, by finding a way around it using slow roll inflation, and second, by invoking an eternal inflationary picture to be a generator for anthropic ideas. So these ideas were kicking around a long time. These ideas sort of were given a new lease on life by the realization that there might be a more complicated kind of potential in string theory that we've come to know and love and call the landscape. So here's a model of the landscape. Here's a 0CCA, a 0CCB, and here's an initial false vacuum. That might be the de Sitter space. Here's some intermediate de Sitter space. That's an example. Now, of course, we imagine that there are a few more minima than this. Okay, but for now, that doesn't matter so much.
So it doesn't bother you that most of vacuum are anti-de-Sitter?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. A very important thing that I've not on this picture is you might have a thing, and you might have an anti-de Sitter. I will assume that this isn't there for a while, and we'll come back later to discuss that. It is of crucial importance, I think, for what goes on that these things exist. Okay, but
it's crucial because the decay rate is much faster. Though.
Yeah, roughly speaking, yeah. If you have something like our world that has a very small CC, it's very easy. These are the things that it will be most easy to decay with generically. So if you want to properly account for decay rates, you have to include them. So. I don't mean to minimize their importance, but it's easier to discuss the situation without them for a while. And a lot of the conceptual, maybe say it this way, the measures were hard enough to think about even without them. So let me do it in steps. Okay, so then you build this bubble diagram. I could draw it in co-moving coordinates. Instead of just having a bubble of, here you might have a bubble of A, and another bubble of B, and you might have a bubble of I that's the sitter that shoots off a lot of bubbles of B, and so you have fractals within bubbles and a more complicated pattern. And it's a question of some interest to figure out some statistics about the number of different kinds of clusters. For instance, suppose you were trying to guess what kind of world we lived in. You might say, if you could count the likelihood of being in A or B, that would tell you the likelihood that we live in A or B. And suppose that measure was enormously peaked around a certain set of parameters that might suggest that we might live in a sharply peaked region. So that's of some interest. It provides the possibility of a selection mechanism that's not based purely on anthropic cuts. Okay.
That's the nature of the volume fraction of A and B. It looks like it's completely well defined.
The volume fraction of A and B is completely well defined, but unfortunately is very sensitive to initial conditions. And so the volume fraction is an example of a measure, but it's a measure that is not useful technically and probably is physically not well motivated for reasons that I'll mention in a minute. But certainly that was the idea that, well, people first, and I think Linde and his collaborators are the first to think seriously about this. And they constructed things like taking some kind of time slice, and along that time slice, compute volumes of A and B in certain kinds of volumes, and actually physical volumes, I think, and just computing the ratio. And unfortunately, the physical volume, as you went to late time, blows up exponentially fast. And so you have enormous amounts of volume to play with, and depending on the way you slice things, you can get any answer you want.
So it is true. You can't just look at the final surface and say it's well.
Right, you can't just do that because it's if everything's infinite. But there is a natural choice, in some sense, in these bubbles, which is co-moving volume, and that is choice dependent.
Sorry, globally, do you really believe there is a well-defined co-moving volume in your fractal nets? I
mean, well, there's a well-moving co-moving coordinate system because you can look at the fractal outside. Okay.
But
Okay, but that certainly is a set of problems. So the first idea is technically what you'd like to do is get rid of this technical problem. The other thing, and I think this is conceptual, and I guess I really learned this from reading Rafael Busso's papers, who is one of the people that's been thinking about measures and has been trying to address this little problem that Rami was raising. If you're doing anthropic reasoning, okay, the crucial thing is that each of these bubbles is a new try at an infinite universe. Okay, you make an infinite FRW universe. It's a new try at having life as we know it. Okay, deciding whether a bubble came earlier and so it has more volume is really irrelevant. What you want to count is the number of tries with a given set of microphysics parameters. Okay, and what that translates into is you should count, if you will, the number of bubbles. Now, the number of bubbles is also infinite, so you have to think about that. But you should not count volumes. You should try to do bubble counting. And bubble counting is a more scale-invariant notion. That's something that's closer to the universal properties of a fractal. And that's how we'll inch toward something that's a universal property of the fractal that has a chance of being well-defined, independent of choices. Yes?
Another related feature is that if you have some perturbations initially, then if on very large scales you get a very anisotropic
field. That's true, yeah.
So, and this is it's related to this issue of having many, many...
Yes, that's right. So it's highly descendant, dependent on fluctuations.
So are you going to think about that?
It won't matter. It would matter explicitly for the kinds of volume-related measures because they would strongly warp the geometry on a given time slice.
Right, it would be a maximum volume.
And so they would be another reason why things would depend sensitively on initial conditions.
So how would counting the bubble avoid that?
I'll show you.
You're just asking for infinite volume, not for reheating or something.
That's right. So this question does not at all say that you have bubbles that are sensible physically. This, if you will, this is just to say, this is a question of what bubbles are more likely. And if suppose that one kind of bubble was essentially infinite and more likely than the other, and that kind of bubble had no reheating, you know, was six-dimensional and looked like bad physics, well, that would be an issue you'd have to think about. Okay. All right, well, so some progress has been made along these reasons in coming up with measures that are less dependent on arbitrary choices than these first attempts. And this is, first of all, let me describe this, because I think this work is important and it's an important taking off point. And in some sense, I think there's something correct about it, a lot correct about it. We'll just have to, if you will, rebrand it a little bit. Okay. All right, and so these are ideas that have been developed in the last few years by two groups. One is Garriga, Schwartz, Perlov, Vilenkin, and Winitsky. I'll call that GSBW, Vilenkin, Winitsky, Schwartz, Perlman, and Garriga. And an independent group, Easter, Lim, and Martin. And it turns out that these people came up with the same measure of bubble counting sort independently. And I'll describe both ways of doing it. The way of understanding it is more picturesque in the way these people talked about. And so I'll describe that first. And it's easier to compute using this formalism. So I'll describe both of them. Okay, so you really are going to have to make a choice between Gonad's colloquium. It's a free country, so. Okay, so let's imagine that you do a fixed set of nucleations. So you have some fixed sort of semi-classical geometry. The solution of Einstein's equation except for some little quantum jumps. So you have an A, and then you have an I, and then let's say that I tunneled into three B hats. Okay. And then what you have to imagine is that this thing is proliferated into a fractal where you have an infinite number of all these kinds, but the kind of pattern of bubbles within bubbles and bubbles is homogeneous. And it's that universality of the fractal that is going to be the crucial point. So the ELM measure is constructed from more or less arbitrary space-like slice. If you will, you can think about it as constant time, co-moving time, and then let some time-like geodesic, time-like line, whirl lines, flow forward. These could be co-moving whirl lines, but they don't have to be. And here's an example, and you take n of them to start. The fact that n is finite is going to be the thing in this approach that will cut off all these infinities up here. It's a kind of coarseness in our measuring grid. We'll see that in a minute. Suppose this is a
Can you say again what n is?
N is the number of world lines that you choose in this, what's it called, a congruence or whatever. Just you select n points more or less at random from any smooth distribution and let some kind of time-like world line proceed from them. And you can make any kind of smooth choice you want about how they're chosen. Then the definition of their measure is you look up here at infinity and you say, you count every cluster that is entered by at least one world line, and you call that a tagged bubble. Sorry, not cluster, a bubble. Okay? And so you have tagged bubbles. Sort of like where a world line has entered one. If more than one world line has entered one, you don't get any extra points for that. It's still tagged. It's either tagged or it's not. All right, this is going to be related to the fact that we're interested in counting bubbles, not the volume in each bubble. Okay.
And here a bubble is just a little pad at the end, or includes?
It includes the de-Sitter as well. So any bubble that has a region that looks like de-Sitter. So this I bubble is counted as a bubble.
Okay.
The one world line can tag more than one bubble?
Yes. One world line can tag more than one bubble, but one bubble can only be tagged. Is it tagged or untagged? Okay. And then the probability of a bubble of X type, that can be A, B, I, whatever, over the probability of Y type is equal to the number of tagged X bubbles over the number of tagged Y bubbles. Very computational. Okay.
It's supposed to be well-defined and large n limit for arbitrary slides.
I haven't said anything about large n yet. I will say those words in just a second. So let me say the words and then you can ask them. Okay. So this is manifestly well-defined for finite n if the fractal has the reasonable property that on average it takes only a finite number of steps to exit inflation, to get to a terminal. A terminal here is defined as something that does not spit out more bubbles. For us, it's A and B. So if on average the cascade ends after a finite time, that doesn't have to be. You could build funny models where that doesn't happen, but that will be an assumption of our cut-on models, and I think it's certainly physically realistic that eventually you'll settle down to a terminal in a finite series of steps.
Are we only interested in ratios of terminal ones, or also?
No, this is any kind of bubble. Okay.
And it's independent of the way you distribute it.
That will be to be proved. Okay, let me. All right, so this, as it's defined, is just something you can compute in a computer. You make a choice, you do this arithmetic.
Okay. The rationale for it is it dependent on all these nice properties, or was there a philosophy behind it beyond that?
There is both, I think. The philosophy is you want to count tries. Okay? So it doesn't matter if a bubble gets nucleated arbitrarily light and has some arbitrarily fine volume at some slice. It still is an independent infinite universe try at using some microphysics parameters to try to just make a universe. Now, you might say, well, shouldn't a bigger universe be weighted with more volume be weighted the same as a smaller universe? The point is that all of these are infinite volume universes. They're all infinite volume FRW universes. The only thing that's different is a small amount of scale factor. And so you have to staple a little bit of scale factor, a finite difference. But in terms of the infinities, they're FRW universes with a symmetry that enables you to define what you mean by infinite volume. No, I think what this is an expectation of what we should see at very, very late times when you're in the deep part of this region. That's right, and we will argue about the convergence. This is certainly something that converges well at large times. The question about whether we have waited long enough to be in that and that asymptotic region is a crucial one, because as you can see, the relevant time scale here is the tunneling time, which is 1 over epsilon. So it's something like e to the 10 to the 12th, it doesn't matter, Planck times years, life of the universe, it doesn't matter. It's an extraordinarily long time. Whether we have lived that long enough, I mean, you know, in some sense we don't know how long we've lived, but there is that sort of very unsettling aspect of these whole sets of ideas. Yeah.
Just to get, the philosophy here is not that you're really proposing this is the final measure that we should use. It's that there are exponential factors involved here that will give very large ratios, and you think before taking care of those, we should worry about how likely it is that this particular set of laws would have led to a galaxy or something. Is that right?
Yeah, I that's right. I think the idea, when I finish it, is that these things will be very non-smooth, right, exponential. And so therefore, the idea is to get those first and then apply anthropic cuts of various kinds. Well, whatever we have, you know.
Yeah. This is done in a fixed set of coordinates. So you're imagining running the computer and letting it do it.
Well, this is completely coordinate independent, right? I choose a slice in a certain density that can be abstractly defined.
The slice is a choice.
Well, I make a geometric choice. You can call it a coordinate choice if you want. I choose an initial slice. Okay, and then after that, there's no coordinate dependence. This is something I can draw with pictures. I can label this picture in any coordinate fashion I wanted.
But the real choice is the time-like curves, right?
Because worldwide slices,
those are far more specific than...
But those are something, you could call them coordinates.
I agree with you, yeah, they're not coordinate dependent in any.
That's right, that's right. But, you could argue how you want, what velocity and acceleration,
Are they geodesics?
They could be, but they don't have to be. It's easier to call them geodesics, but it doesn't matter.
If the final volume is much, much larger than the initial volume, then you start to get into ambiguity.
All right, let me finish the argument before we get into these subtleties. Yes?
So are you assuming that epsilon is much less than 1 between all these different, all these problems?
Implicitly, I am, yes. Yeah, but what that has to do with is I never have to worry about collisions in any one of these hierarchies. I think, as usual, that assumption is very good. Okay. Okay, so what you do, this defines a probability measure. This gives ratios, and then you sum them up and normalize them. Okay. And then we take the final probability, so you take, as people guessed already, you take the limit n going to infinity. And the question is, does that limit exist? And if it exists, is it independent of choices like this? And the claim is, it almost certainly exists, because what you're getting at is the finest, the thing that's going to dominate, that's going to make the most tagged bubbles, are the finest bubbles in this cascade. This initial bubble here, this is going to count 1. But if you have this very fine, if n is 10 to the 12th, you're going to hit 10 to the 12th bubbles at this grading of order 10 to the minus 12 in co-moving volume. Okay, so taking n to infinity is like taking a cutoff on the size of the bubbles in some sense, but it's covariantized. It doesn't, haven't specified it in any way. And so the answer is, this will be, I've given a heuristic, but I think one can prove this, that this has a smooth large n limit, only subject to the proviso that this fractal process has a smooth scale invariant limit, and that we can establish independently. Yes?
Maybe there's something missing, but if I knew what the geometry was and I had one big bubble that all went to A and stopped, I could choose an infinite number of world lines that all went there.
Right.
And I would get a different answer than if I chose...
That's non-generic. Okay.
So there is some measure.
There's a measure on the space of
one. You can make statements like non-generic.
Yeah, I did. I said smooth choices. A density that vanishes to zero and goes to zero is not smooth.
You think you could prove that for generic choices there's...
Yeah. Okay, so let me give that argument. So suppose you pick some initial densities here. And it's given by some continuous... I guess I want more than continuous. I want smooth. So I can avoid things like where it doesn't vanish. Maybe I want to avoid things where it vanishes. I actually think I could tolerate things that vanish. Because generically, there won't be a bubble sitting exactly on top of this. Okay. So generically, for nice distributions, what happens is that the part that gives all the dominance is a very, very tiny part here that's addressed by this very, very tiny part of the initial condition. And any reasonable function is constant across that initial condition. And so as long as you have a density that's constant, you get the same statistics. So by focusing on the tiniest part of these bubbles, all you care about is that this function is locally constant. And if it's locally constant, it treats all the different bubbles. You can't have radical differences between the different bubbles because the initial due to the distribution. And so that's essentially the proof of independence of initial slicing. Okay. So I think this picture tells you that you don't depend on time slicing. There's no elaborate coordinate choice here, and it's independent in a smooth way on all initial choices. Now you can make, just a second, you can make qualitatively different choices that give you a completely different measure. I don't mean to say that this measure is unique in any sense. You could choose that the probabilities for every different kind of bubble are the same. That's a perfectly well-posed measure. So the point is that this measure is not sensitively dependent to any arbitrary choices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild behavior that's very different from
that. All bets are off.
So when you said before that this would be insensitive, that's not
as long as the geometry evolves to a smooth place.
Right.
If there was
suppose more generically it's much more robust.
Oh no, as long as in the past, I don't know, you have some singularity there, that doesn't matter. As long as it evolves, as long as like it's smooth here, that's all that matters.
So one should ask, how likely is that?
I think that's quite likely, though, isn't it? I mean, usually you have a singularity in the past, the only place where this is going to happen is in these FRW crunches. And so, if I rule these out, I think the probability of making singularities in the future is rather unlikely. Well, for argument's sake here, but we will have to deal with them. You're right. And then what we would do is when each one of those bubbles, there's no reason for that to be an infinite number of bubbles that I can see. It'll be, some finite amount. Within each of those bubbles, you do this picture. And then if you wait long enough, the number of these bubbles will far dominate the number of ones you shot out at the beginning. Okay, so that's, you're right. But if you start with 100,000 different bubbles, you have to do the statistic in each one. But the fact that this statistics doesn't depend on what kind of bubble you start with, you'll get asymptotically the same measure. Okay. Asymptotically means a long time. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
What if it's not connected?
Which part?
You've got it and have one part.
You know that there's a simple answer and a hard answer. I think the simple answer is it's not very important, but there's a very deep issue where that comes up that I'll talk about later on. That is the most irritating. I'm telling you, my plane is at 7. What are you worried about? I'm sure by 7 I will talk about everything that I'm interested in. I promise you that. But I think the simplest concern is that about having some multiply connected thing here is not so important. Like you imagine the co-moving coordinates are periodically identified or something there.
The landscape has multiple components that don't tunnel between each other.
Is that what you meant?
Space. Yeah.
Oh, you mean pipe, not multiply connected, but disconnected. let me defer that, okay? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. Anything else?
Yeah, you just said that if you had these different initial bubbles, mm-hmm. you could do this in each bubble, and that the answer wouldn't depend on which bubble you started in.
Yes.
But if I start, for example, in bubble I, then by your rules, don't I never get an F?
Yeah. Right. So I have to make a mild assumption on the statistics here that you can always go up and down, no matter how unfrequently, except for these final terminals. So then the mild assumption I add is you don't start in a terminal.
But in fact, to make it independent of which bubble you started, don't you need some kind of
ergodicity
balance assumption that the up and down transition rates are the same?
No. No, you don't need them the same. It just means that they're non-zero. Even if it's much less, suppose if it's very unlikely that you get here, yeah. Like a probability of a millionth of a percent, if you get there and this bubble's plus cascade is going to dominate, if you wait an infinitely long time, it will still dominate. Even though the coefficient that you start with is very small, the number of bubbles will go to infinity in that other choice and will dominate that small up jump. Okay. All right, so I'll give you the mathematics, actually, for deciding this. But that, all you need is some technical ergodicity among the non-terminals.
Okay.
which probably is true, actually, if you leave out these pesky ADSs. But among de Sitters, you do jump up and down.
Steve, are the ADSs really pesky if they don't recycle? You're just worried about recycling?
I'm worried about recycling. Recycling would be the one issue. I'm also worried about... If their volume, they could be dominating, and then you could use an anthropic cut to eliminate them.
They're all
pressure. Yeah, right. But the most important factor for these considerations is if they recycle. Yeah.
Let's just say this, we could also continue this next week.
I don't have anything else to do this afternoon. Does anybody else?
Well, I think some of us are planning to change the channel.
Others of us may not be able to sit here for 5 hours at a stretch.
I'm at your disposal. Okay. I'm happy to do whatever.
I mean, I think we're all happy to hear about it, and then give us a little case.
All right. So who are the nominal organizers? I'll let the organizers choose. Shama, you're excluded for self-interest. I'm sure you don't want any of this group coming to your colloquium, so I'm sure you have a strong prejudice the other way.
I think you should just continue the
Zendi
Club.
I would be happy to, but...
Then I'll never forget to hire other shrinkers at Santa Barbara.
No comment. All right, well, so should I just keep talking until 4 and then we stop? What?
3:30.
Okay. My conclusions are... All right, so let me think about... And then the plan is to continue it next week?
You can say your conclusions next week, too, if you want.
No, I wouldn't conclude. That would be far too disciplined of me now. I should pick... So we stop at 3:30, and then the idea is we pick up for next week. So I have to review what I've said next week. Tell me what you want to do. I'm really at your disposal. You want to stop at 3:30 now, and then what do you want to do next week?
We want to have you address your talk next week.
Okay, but suppose I go for 8 hours. Does that mean I
will shoot you before you do that.
That does open up a job. I can't guarantee it'll be a string job.
The question is whether you convert the late fund or not.
Yeah, the talk is planned to converge at about double the time that I can actually give you an estimate of the recurrence time. Not the decay time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is about halfway through. All right. So I will try to wind up now. What I will do, this represents this fancy measure, which for arbitrary reasons we have been calling 2. You can think of this as M and M theory. The 2 could stand for 2 very smart groups coming up at the same time. The 2 actually stands for the fact that there was a previous measure that they liked that we didn't like called 1. However you want. Let me talk about a few properties of 2.
Absolutely.
Please, you have...
Statements or not? I mean, the statement that as M goes to infinity, these ratios really approach qualifying things. Are you conjecturing this as true?
But you want me... You're asking a small and S kind of question. Is that right? All right. It is not. I think it is not a theorem, but it is true beyond a reasonable doubt. I actually mean that quite sincerely.
Yeah.
Okay. I believe with sufficient work.
In the correlation picture, it's clear what this means. There's some ratios of things and phases.
Actually, you mean the diagnostic in terms... I think this is the best diagnostic in terms of percolation statistics. Okay, but yes, I...
Well, for example, could you make it sharper in one of these point models based on the percolation, like the Grandelbaum?
Actually, the place where you make it sharper, calculationally, is in the approach these guys use, where you write... Again, when you think about a Cantor set, you know, it's better than drawing pictures. You write kind of recurrence relations for probabilities. It turned into an analytic statement. And here it's continuous, so you write differential equations for the probabilities of various kinds of droplets. And in those differential equations, you can see a lot of the independence that we're talking about. So that's that satisfies a one powerful part of the independence that's proved there. For instance, the fact that you converge to a unique answer. There it's a question, basically, you have a linear rate equation, which we'll write down next time, and it's a question about whether there are zero eigenvalues corresponding to the terminals, and there's a leading non-zero eigenvalue corresponding to the convergence. And the question is that approach unique? And there's a theorem for this kind of matrices, that there's a unique eigenvalue. Okay, so that's the kind of analytic argument that we can give you. The question there is independence of the choice of time coordinate. This picture, I think, makes it manifest. It doesn't depend on that. So I think by a hodgepodge of those things, I'm trying to give you an estimate. I believe that QCD exists with higher certainty. I believe that N equals 4 Yang Mills exists with higher certainty.
You think an interpolation or something?
Yeah. I should be careful in that I haven't, you know, spent the many years studying this that would be necessary to really establish this. But I think this is, in some of my correspondence with Lee Smolin, I needed to establish a definition of truth. And the definition I offered him was that if he asserted something was true beyond a reasonable doubt and it proved to be false, he would donate a year's salary to charity.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think I'd be willing to donate a month's salary to charity.
Do you have it? I mean, aside from proofs, do you have a formulation of the theorem to be proved?
Yeah.
All the assumptions that you're assuming.
Yeah. But like all good things, like the existence of QCD, the formulation comes with the, you know, as you understand. Well, the formulation wasn't clear until we had lattice techniques and stuff, you know. I mean, yeah. Okay. Yes, I think we can make a. Yes, here we can make a precise formulation that states something to be proved.
And enumerate all the assumptions that you have to call.
Yeah, yeah.
That you just discussed a few.
Yeah.
Like disconnected based on
the belief. Yeah, I would put.
But every time something comes up, you say, well, yeah.
Steve, the next question is, does KMTP count as a charity?
This bet, actually, I thought about this. Bet was structured to be a charity of his choice, which meant he could donate it to Perimeter. So that was a slight problem. But I think he's still. Well, let me not get into that. Maybe that's where we should stop. But actually, all right. Let me then estimate in this particular geometry I chose, where you have one big A bubble and an I bubble with three little B bubbles. How does this measure come out? Okay, with the whirl lines I've drawn, what would be the approximation to this measure? Well, let me do terminals. PA over PB here. I have one tagged A bubble. It's tagged multiple times, but it's still just tagged. And here, these three lines tag B bubbles. And so there are three tagged B bubbles. So PA over PB is 1 over 3. Okay. Now suppose I run this thing much later and I have little tiny, there's a fractal process, so I have lots of B bubbles in here. And so I make this double the number of whirl lines. Essentially every whirl line hits an independent B bubble, but they all hit the same A bubble. So this goes to 1 over N, which goes to 1 over infinity, which equals 0. So in this thing, with appropriate choices of rates, in particular that this I vacuum has to be quite long-lived, meaning this tunneling rate is rather small, and this thing doesn't exit from eternal inflation or something. It's actually stronger than that. The B bubbles are infinitely more likely than A. Statistically, you will never find an A. And the reason is, every time you make an I, it lives so long, it spits out an infinite number of Bs. The B bubbles are infinitely more fine-grained. They occur at much later times, so they, in the sand, the grains are arbitrarily fine-grained. These A bubbles, once they're made, they just stay there. Roughly speaking, suppose the probability to go from F into I are both the same. Then every time you make an A, there's an I. So that statistic cancels out. But in I, you make an infinite number of Bs.
You also make A from I.
No, that's ruled. In this picture, let's rule that out. If you added that, you would have a slight change. So it's a simple model. Let's just assume. Yeah. Let me draw the simplified graph that you just have these rates.
The ratio is literally zero.
The ratio in the limit. The limit of n going to infinity, infinite time, in the fractal, the measure is zero.
So now, if you lived in an AU, you'd be really surprised.
Yeah, quite right.
In fact, are you predicting that you should live in a place that had many, many small jumps?
What do you mean?
Got that extra volume by jumping from that to I.
No, the jump, each whorl line just has two jumps, you know, from I into B. There's not many jumps.
I meant in a landscape.
Yeah.
Many more vacuums.
This measure favors. I is long lived, all vacua, desiderata vacua in some sense live for an infinite time because inflation is eternal. By long lived, I mean the rate out is small. Okay.
And setting the I to A rate to zero is so artificial that. What if it's not zero?
Oh, as long as it's small, the measure is almost, the ratio.
Almost zero is a not a useful concept. How does it depend parametrically?
Is it true that the ratio is the ratio? That's the question. If they're both exponentially suppressed.
I believe what happens is if this rate is small but non-zero, then this is not infinity, it's the ratio of those branching ratios.
Yeah.
Okay, so it could be 10 to the 12th,
sure,
which is a good approximation to infinity.
Okay, but it's a good approximation to infinity only because you made those branching ratios a good approximation to infinity.
Yeah. No.
But if the branching ratios are 1 to 2, or...
Well, when you have exponentials of instanton ratios, that's pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
No. The point is, what I'm saying is irrelevant to the size of these things. This is an algorithm for predicting these probabilities. They might be almost the same, or they might be different. Okay. There's an algorithm for deciding them. But the point I want to make from this measure is that it enormously favors the progeny of long-lived vacua. That's the slogan for these kind of measures.
But they call this progeny of long-lived vacua.
Well, suppose there were many bees here that could be gotten to with roughly equal rate. By locus, yes, that's right. Favors progeny of long lived.
Why does it be long lived? Why can't some of them eternally inflating?
No, because if they're eternally inflating, this rate is, this epsilon is close to 1. The amount of the fineness of the bubbles is not very fine. Okay, so you don't get this enormous enhancement. In fact, here there's a sharp phase transition. It's not a phase transition. There's a sharp crossover between having these ratios be finite and infinite, depending on that rate. Okay, but it's not eternal inflating is not enough. It's how fine you chop the thing, which corresponds to how dense the fractal is. Okay, this thing is measuring the denseness of the fractal.
Actually, Steve, anything that's actually infinitely
long-lived,
this picture totally dies.
By infinitely long-lived, what do you mean? No exits.
No exits. Like, for instance, new eternal inflations.
Where? In this picture,
no permanent exits.
The terminals are...
Yeah, that's right. I think I would like to group these in these things we call terminals.
Okay.
Okay, so there's room in there for these. Okay, and it could be that they're highly favored.
Call stable visitor space a terminal in that sense.
That's right. Well, yes, that's right. I would call it that. Terminal, there could be uprates. I'm not ruling those out, even though often we don't have them, but you can have them.
In this case, the initial condition doesn't matter. If I start at F, then you get your answer. If I start at I.
They're because of this special picture of only down. Suppose I have slight recyclings. Then it doesn't. Then even if they're very small, it doesn't matter.
Why not? Because if I start at I, then A actually becomes the most likely by the same argument.
Why?
No.
Because I have the same picture, even though the chance of going to F is very small, I only have one B region.
No, it doesn't.
Have many A.
It doesn't work like that. Basically, what happens is, if you start in I, you have enormous. If you start in F.
No, I started. Let's suppose I start in I.
Okay. Well, then you have all Bs and no As.
No, if I have a small chance of going to F.
Yeah, but the point is, you have a much better chance. Let's bound that. You're saying the probability of A is no higher than starting completely in F.
No. I don't think. Let's draw a picture. Start with I.
Yeah.
Somewhere it has an F with very low probability.
Yeah.
F will spool out very many A's, or only one.
Well, see, I'm assuming that this rate is slower than this rate. I want I to be almost stable. That's what it means to be almost stable.
You want F to be almost stable to go to stable.
No, these rates are all, they're all small to be eternal. But I want these two numbers to be fast compared to, this is like epsilon, this is epsilon, and let's say this is epsilon squared. And in fact, as these two rates become the same, there's a crossover between these numbers and another set of numbers. A sharp algebraic crossover. It can be sharp because you're going to infinite time. And I'll show you how to compute these. Well, I only have an hour and a half next week, so I probably won't.
But you do know how to compute these?
Yes.
As a function of the rate?
Absolutely. And that's the work of GSVW. They give this linearized rate equation for this Cantor set thing, and it's eigenvalues and eigenvectors of that rate matrix.
But you have to give a tree before.
Yeah, you give a tree and numbers on the tree.
And the tree is based on these one-dimensional pictures?
No, the tree is anything you want it to be. You can base it, for instance, in a very interesting picture paper. Valinkin and this collaborator, Schwartz-Perloff, ran their measure on the Busso-Polchinski landscape using instanton evaluations of the rates. It's an interesting thing to do.
As the number of vacua becomes very large, what's called a vacua, is there going to be chaotic dependence in your answers on the rates connecting the L vacua to each other?
That's an interesting question. I think. Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, and I think probably not, because in some sense, if it's only 10, it depends on the number of vacuums related to 1/epsilon. If there's only 10^500 vacuum, that's nothing compared to these decay rates. So I would guess no. Okay, but if there were 10^ if there are 1/epsilon vacuums, then it would be trickier.
We said for any fixed number of vacuum, if you wait long enough.
Right. You'll propagate the proliferate the tree. All right. So your homework is, suppose that we live in one of these progeny of long-lived vacua because they are favored by what I assert is a nice measure. Okay. Why? Why is our vacuum the progeny of a long-lived vacuum? I'll stop there. Yeah. What do I do with them? I think I actually have some complaints about them, so you should too. Okay. The question is, what do they mean? I mean, as you know, the simplest GR picture, and when you fall into an anti-de Sitter minimum, is it's not anti-de Sitter; it crunches. And the question is, what does the singularity mean in terms of a situation where you have some nice, let's say, asymptotically supersymmetric bubbles, okay, that are stable, and then let's say they're hit by a crunching anti-de Sitter bubble, and then there's another, so this is an A and an A, and suppose A's are really Suzy minima that can't be eaten up. Okay, what does this geometry mean? Okay, now the only situation I can analyze is we're looking from the top, and this is suppose these are A bubbles, and they make a closed ring. And in the center, you have this ADS crunch. So you rotate that. I think this has to be a black hole. Okay, and a black hole recycles. This is a finite mass black hole in asymptotically flat FRW space. And so I think it recycles. But in these situations where their bubbles don't surround it, and in some sense you have an entire universe of crunching hooked onto an entire universe, I don't even know the GR. In fact, the GR situation here is really interesting, and I would love to get experts to tell me what's going on. So suppose from the top you have an A bubble that's 0cc FRW, and then it's hit by some kind of thing that forms a singularity. What does that evolve into at late time? Does this singularity get, what's the word, invaginated and turn into a black hole? Or does it form a... That is a technically correct word. If you look on the sky, do you see finite dark patches that correspond to sort of dark horizons where the singularity is shielded from? This is a GR question, and I can't even come close to figuring it out. But I'm
a black hole.
No, I don't think it has to be black hole.
From the outside?
There is no outside. Here, this is the only outside you can talk about. The outside here is a de Sitter.
Yes, the outside here is a de Sitter.
No, but the point is, I want to ask from the point of view of an FRW observer. What do they see? It's an infinite FRW frame. It gets hit by this thing. When they look at it, what do they see?
But it could be way outside of Schwarzschild radius, right?
The Schwarzschild radius for what?
The black hole of this mass.
Not when the bubbles hit. The whole thing is positive.
When you just form a bubble, it forms a zero amount.
I know, but here when you have collisions, they can form positive amounts.
Yeah, it's important that they come on in order to find out what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, because I only care about what this observer sees, as you'll hear about next week.
So you don't have, like,
the delta line? No. Well, they don't collide. They're just in the sitter space, and they're the sitter black holes problem.
Well, they're
I guess that's right. Yes, they can be. They could be. That's right. So I don't know what they are. That's another question. What are they? They're big crunches is what they are. Yes.